This time to chapter 5. And we're going to read the first 19 verses. I'm going to deal with the chapter in two parts. So, 2 Kings chapter 5, verses 1 to 19. Now, Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy." As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message, "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, "Go, wash 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed." But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord, his God, wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?" So he went off in a rage. Naaman's servants went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed?" So he went down and dipped himself into the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, "Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. So please accept a gift from your servant." The prophet answered, "As surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing." And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. "If you will not," said Naaman, "please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry, for your servant will never again make a burnt offering and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord. But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down, and he is leaning on my arm, and I have to bow there also. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this." "Go in peace," said Elisha. Well, as we look at the life and times of Elisha on a Sunday evening, we're seeing the grace of God being extended to lots of different people, aren't we? Let's just spend a few moments recapping. Turn back with me to chapter 2, verses 19 to 22. In these verses, we saw the grace of God extending to the people at Jericho, so that their bitter waters might be healed. If you look at chapter 3, verses 1 to 27, you will see the grace of God being extended to the Israelites as they gain victory over a revolting Moab. And then look at chapter 4, verses 1 to 7. We see the grace of God being extended to this widow, so that she had enough oil to pay off her debts and keep hold of her two sons that she was afraid of losing. And then look at chapter 4, verses 42 to 44. We see that the grace of God is extended to the 100, so that there was enough food for them to eat. Have I missed out the death in the pot story? I think I have. We know that grace was extended there, wasn't it? So that the poisonous gourds that had been put in the stew were not able to affect the men, that the stew was made edible. But it's story after story, isn't it, where we see the grace of God extended to different people. Sometimes we hear people saying, oh, when you read the Old Testament, it's all about the judgment of God. Well, that can't be said if one reads through the story of Elisha. Well, in this chapter that we're looking at tonight, we see the grace of God going international, that is, extending beyond the borders of Israel to the country of Aram. Indeed, the grace of God is extended to one particular individual called Naaman. And I'm guessing that this is a story that we all know well. It's probably a story that we've heard told many times. Perhaps it's a story that we've told many times ourselves, or preached many times ourselves. We're not going to look at the whole story in detail. I think we could probably spend quite a few weeks looking at it together. There's so much that's contained within it. But I'm simply going to stress two things this evening. Firstly, God's unmistakable providence, and secondly, God's unmistakable saving work. Firstly, God's unmistakable providence. This man Naaman had everything, didn't he? Wealth, honor, prestige. He was a successful man. The king of Aram was very complimentary about him. He greatly respected him. He had gained lots of victories for his country. And yet he had leprosy, or some other kind of skin disease, that the Hebrew word translated leprosy in our Bibles is used to speak of all kinds of skin diseases. But we'll stick with leprosy in order to keep things simple. But perhaps the worst thing was that he knew nothing of the saving grace of Israel's God. But God, in his providence, was clearly at work in the circumstances of human life in order to bring him to an appreciation of God's grace. Here we read about a young girl who lived in Israel, and yet she was captured by a band of raiders from Aram and brought back to Aram. And of all the places where she could have been located, it just so happened that it was in Naaman's household. Indeed, she effectively became the maid of Naaman's wife. Now, even in that household, we could, I think, have expected this young girl to have despised her owners, to have despised Naaman, And yet we find her expressing sympathy towards him because of his leprosy. And even going so far as to say to her mistress, "I know someone in Israel, the prophet of the Lord, who could heal Naaman of his leprosy. Why don't you tell him about this man, Elisha?" Unbelievers often talk about luck, don't they, or chance. But as believers, we're not willing to speak using that terms. We recognise that God works providentially in this world in which we live in order to fulfil his purposes. I've been leaning, I suppose, quite a lot on this lovely little commentary on 2 Kings by Dale Ralph Davis. Now, I think I've recommended his Old Testament commentaries before, but as far as I'm concerned, he's one of the best around and very, very readable, and I commend his books to you. But let me read here what he says. He says, "Sometimes the means God uses to bring people to himself seem, well, so incidental. A captive girl. Or a discarded book." And then he speaks about Arno, whose surname I can't pronounce, who sent a free copy of his first book, Studies in Zechariah, to every rabbi in Greater New York City, and never received an acknowledgement from any of them. After a while, however, a young Hebrew Christian began to attend one of his meetings. He had been secretary to a well-known rabbi. The rabbi had tossed Studies in Zechariah into the wastebasket, but the secretary had fished it out, read it, and trusted Christ. And Davis goes on to say, "Yahweh's sovereignty is so fascinating." Secondly, God's unmistakable saving work. Firstly, God's unmistakable providence, but secondly, God's unmistakable saving work. So then, Naaman, having been given permission by the king to go to Israel, makes his way there, and we know that it takes a little while for him to eventually arrive at Elisha's front door. Even then, Elisha doesn't come out to speak to him, but the message is clear. He is to go and wash in the River Jordan 7 times. As we know, he's somewhat reluctant to do this at first, a bit too proud to do what is asked of him, but eventually he's persuaded by his servants or by his attendants to do so, and we know the story of how he was cleansed of his leprosy. But it's this miracle that God performs in his life that is used to bring him to a trust or a belief in him. And there are three things that give clear evidence of Naaman becoming a true believer in the God of Israel. The first is a wonderful confession. Look at verse 15. "Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, 'Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. So please accept a gift from your servant.'" Now that's a remarkable confession, isn't it? Before now, this man has heard nothing, or at least very little, of the God of Israel. But now he says, "There is no God in all the world except in Israel." But not only do we see his confession, we see his resolution. Look at verse 17. If you will not, this is in response to Elisha, who won't accept a gift from him. If you will not, said Naaman, please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry, for your servant will never again make a burnt offering and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord. It seems that he wants to take some soil back with him to his home country in order that he might sacrifice to the one true and living God on the appropriate soil. A wonderful confession, a wonderful resolution, but thirdly we see his sensitivity to the things of God. Wonderful sensitivity. Look at verse 18. But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down, and he is leaning on my arm, and I have to bow there also, when I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this. I wonder what you make of this. Some commentators are really quite critical of Naaman for saying this, but I'm reluctant to criticise Naaman. You see, there was no desire on his part to bow down to this false god. In fact, even when he was bowing down, I think he would argue that I'm not really bowing down. I'm only kneeling down because I need to serve my human master, my king. And it's interesting, isn't it, what Elisha says in verse 19. In fact, this is what really persuades me not to be highly critical of him, if critical at all. Elisha, the prophet of the Lord, says, go in peace. And it's as if Elisha, he's not wanting to be critical of him, rather understanding of him. Now, whether you agree with that or not, I don't know. Perhaps that could become a topic of conversation after the service. But at the very least, we see a wonderful sensitivity, don't we, to the things of God. And oh, that the people in Israel had such a sensitivity to the things of God. He was a man from a faraway country that did not know the God of Israel, and yet those in the land, those who had entered into a covenant with God, weren't sensitive to the things of God at all. They were going to Dan. They were going to Bethel. They were engaging in the worship of the Baals there. Indeed, they were engaging in syncretic worship. That is, they were worshipping the God of Israel and the Baals. Elijah, you remember, had challenged them to choose between the two. Choose this day whom you may serve. But how quickly they began to slide into their idolatrous ways again. And as I was preparing for this evening, it challenged me, and I challenge you this evening. How sensitive are we to offending God by the way we think, or the way we speak, or the way we act? Naaman experienced the grace of God. Firstly, in being healed of his leprosy, and secondly, in being brought to faith in him. And what a wonderful transformation we see in Naaman's life. Let me finish my reading to you a little more from this commentary. You see, where God does a work in somebody's life, he brings about transformation, doesn't he? Ralph Davis says, God's work leaves clear evidence. And then he goes on to say this. It's like the lad near Sandfields. Sandfields was where Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones went to carry out his first pastorate. It's like the lad near Sandfields, who told his teacher about the dinner his family had enjoyed one noon. Gravy, potatoes, meat, cabbage, even rice pudding. Then he explained it all. My father has been converted. What he had spent on Friday night to booze himself silly, he now brought home to feed his family. Or, goes on, Davis. Or there was a domestic servant who wanted to join the Metropolitan Tabernacle, and Spurgeon was quizzing her about her faith. When he pressed her for evidence that Christ had changed her, she blushed and admitted, "Well, I sweep under the carpets now." In one case, it may be a cabbage and rice pudding. In another, a broom under mats. But God's transforming work leaves traces in its way. And that's so true, isn't it? God's saving work leaves traces in its way. Can we thank God for the wonderful work of grace that he did in Naaman's life all those years ago? Well, we're going to sing again about God's